And I'm Elise.
And this is the Faithful Feminist Podcast.
But this is not just any Come Follow Me podcast. We do things a little differently here. We offer approachable feminist interpretations of the Come Follow Me manual for those who want to study and understand the scriptures in a framework of equality, social justice, and sisterhood. We are here to show you all the really good ways that faith and feminism work together to illuminate and deepen the gospel experience.
We've saved you a seat on the soft chairs, so join us today for a conversation about 3 Nephi, chapters 1 through 7, for the dates September 7th through the 13th. We're so glad you're here today.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us on another episode of The Faithful Feminists. Before we jump into the chapters, there are a few things that Channing and I wanted to spend just a bit of time talking about. And recently, we've been receiving lots of amazing DMs and emails saying, like, spreading love and appreciation for the podcast, but also offering new perspectives or offering your own interpretations. And we wanted to say, good job. That is exactly what this podcast is all about, finding personal, meaningful ways to interpret the text.
Right. I love getting those because it shows me that we're not the only ones that are engaging with all of our hearts and all of our minds and all of our might. So it's really cool to get those DMs. And Elise and I just want to reinforce and remind you, because we haven't talked about this in a long time, but Elise and I aren't experts on the text, so we don't know everything. We're just here offering our own interpretation from a feminist lens of the scriptures, just like all of you are doing too. So what we offer here on the podcast isn't meant to be prescriptive. It's not meant to be authoritative. It's just meant to be an open door for you to walk through and explore more. It's a starting point. It's a conversation that is meant to open you up to new ideas and to encourage you to read the scriptures in a new and radical way. And so we're really grateful to see all of the ways that you are interpreting these stories and that the text is speaking to you. So we just want to remind you that, like, we love you and we're doing the exact same thing. So don't ever, like, I hope you never walk away from the episode feeling like, oh, well, Channing and Elise said it should be this way, so it should be this way. Like, we're not that powerful.
No, but we do hope that we can show you, like, that the scriptures come to life when you engage with them in new ways and when you're in conversation with really important people or people in your wards and branches. This is the way that the scriptures are a living book, is by having these conversations and wrestling with them and being open to new understandings and new perspectives.
Right. And going along with that too, we love receiving all of the DMs about the text. We don't always have time to answer every single one of them. And so our best piece of advice is find a friend. Not that we won't get to your DM eventually, but like, find a friend who you can talk to about these scriptures. And I know that that's sometimes easier said than done. But for Elise and I especially, having someone to like bounce ideas off of and hear different perspectives from has really changed our scripture study. And so if you can find a friend or a scripture reading partner or even your spouse who's interested in reading the text in these similar and radical ways, it can really transform your scripture reading. And so, yeah, we just encourage you to do that if you can, because it's amazing and it's a great experience. And it's different than like your gospel doctrine Sunday school, like, here is the one way to read the text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bring up a great point. We try and offer a way or just one way to read the text, but it's not the way, the only way, or even the correct way. It's just our way that we've found important and meaningful.
Yep. So we love you guys. Keep sending DMs. Just be patient with us as we work through all of them and try to respond to all of them with all of our love and care, because that's how we feel for each one of you. So
yes,
we just wanted to put that out there.
This week, we also received a really awesome DM asking us about kind of the state of our faith and why we choose to stay in the church when we have such divergent or even radical understandings of faith and church and feminism. And this is not the first time that we've received a question like this. So what our plan is that we hope to make a mini kind of bonus episode answering this DM. And hopefully it will be able to inspire our listeners or at least provide a bit more context on our own faith experiences.
Right. So look for that later this week, or if you're listening like on Sunday, just look through the episode list for this week, and we'll post about it on Instagram too. So you can listen to that bonus episode.
Yes, yes, yes. So now let's get to it. In this set of chapters, we are in the very beginning of 3rd Nephi, the book of 3rd Nephi. And in this, there's 7 chapters that we cover, and there is signs and miracles that lead up to Jesus's birth. And there's also this tension that grows between the believers and the unbelievers. In chapter 1, verse 7, it says, "The unbelievers cause a great uproar throughout the land." This tension is real. They're saying that, no, the time has already passed for these prophecies that Samuel the Lamanite prophesied about to be fulfilled, and they're not happening, so this all must just be a sham.
And they go one step further. They don't even just say, like, oh, these are a sham. They say, we're going to kill anyone who believes this.
Right.
So it's, like, a great
more severe.
Yeah. But, like, on steroids.
Yeah. It gets pretty serious. And to even heighten that tension even more, we have another run-in with the Gadianton robbers. And almost every time I read these new set of Come Follow Me chapters, I'm like, wait, what? I thought they were gone. I thought they had been like totally wiped out, but they just keep showing up. And I think this set of scriptures shows the power and the like just wickedness of the Gadianton robbers, because they're trying to make big moves to not just wipe the people out, but like take the people captive.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In 3rd Nephi chapter 1 verses like 10 through 14, this is when Nephi is praying mightily to God because the unbelievers and their enemies have threatened to kill all of those who believe in the signs that were foretold by Samuel the Lamanite. And in an answer to Nephi's prayer, God responds and says, like, don't be afraid. These signs of Christ's birth will be fulfilled this very same night. And so one of the things Channing and I wanted to talk about is this idea of signs and proof, or fulfillment as proof. I find it interesting here about what counts as proof, because Samuel the Lamanite is not the first prophet to talk about his experiences, his dreams and visions, and his prophecies that he's had. I'm sure that many people on the ground level too have had intimate experiences with God and visions of God and have come to a true testimony and belief that these things are going to happen. But those aren't the things that count as, quote, proof. These stories and this lived experience of the people is really not enough. These personal accounts aren't enough. And so the unbelievers are kind of like sitting there tapping their watches like, well, you said, but I don't believe just your words. I need to see it in a physical, tangible way that this is going to happen, or else I won't believe it.
I think you're right. I think the people want something big and miraculous that shows up to them so that they have all their answers. They want something that takes away the uncertainty of having to decide, is this true or is it not true? They want something that will last for centuries so that they never have to worry about it ever again. And this makes it easy for them, right? Like, they don't have to think about it anymore because it's black and white. You don't have to choose when the choice is made for you.
And to that same point, this isn't even something that God can offer, because just a few verses before, the Nephites did have these big miraculous signs and wonders appear to them, and even that wasn't enough, right? Even when the sign comes, or even when the prophecy is fulfilled, it's not enough to sustain them. It's not enough to solidify their faith. And I'm not saying that we should strive to solidify our faith. Actually, I think personally the opposite. I think that we should have a fragile faith that is open and able to receive wonder and miracle at any point. And that we remember those miracles and that we're not so quick to forget them.
Yeah, I feel the same as you. Like our faith should be fragile. And as I was listening to you talk about that, I kind of was thinking, like, the image that came to my mind as you were talking about faith was actually a river. Like the river flows and it's contained, right? Like it's contained within the banks of this river. It's contained by the earth, but it flows easily and it follows a path, but it's always being refreshed. It's always moving. It's always changing and it's not like stagnant.
Yeah, and it's never too sure of itself. I think that's where we can fall into the trap of fundamentalism, where we think that our way is the one and only way. And I think the idea of having a fragile or flexible or open faith, or faith like a river, is one that is never sure of itself, one that is always looking for God in whatever ways God might show up.
And I think this conversation about faith and a more flexible and open faith actually lends itself pretty well to nuance. A question that has been coming to my mind as I have been thinking about these chapters this week is, can it be both? Like, can we want to have our faith validated and also know that maybe it never will be? Can we desire proof but also sit in doubt and cleave to hope? Does it have to be just certainty or uncertainty, or can we make space for both in our faith journeys and in our worship spaces and in our communities? Like, can there be room for both? And I think the very definition of faith says yes, because if it's certainty, it's not faith, because it's already been made sure. And so what's the point?
I'm so glad you asked those questions. That nuance and that being able to hold both of these seemingly like opposite ends of the spectrum, I think that is really important. I think that showcases a mature faith, because I think if we swing too far on either side, we can find ourselves in a really precarious place. Like, if I swing too far on the doubtful side, I could start to become a little bit like, I could slip into nihilism. Like, well, nothing matters. Nothing is true. I don't believe in anything, right? I think when people who are experiencing faith transition express their doubts and questions, I think outside members looking in on that think, oh my gosh, they've swung way too far on the other side and they'll never make it back. But I don't think that's the case. But also, if we swing too far on the other end, it's almost like we're not open to hearing anything new, because we already know for a surety, and nothing can shake our, quote, sure foundation. But I appreciate you bringing the idea of hope into it, because I think that's a generous reading of these people's experience here. The believers are hoping that the prophecies are fulfilled. I'm sure that not all of them knew that they would be fulfilled, but they hope that they will be fulfilled. And I think that hope is something that spurs or carries on our faith into new, deeper, mature levels.
I also find fundamentalism playing a huge part in this story of kind of like the believers versus the non-believers. And where I actually see fundamentalism playing a huge part in the unbelievers. I think that, you know, throughout this chapter and throughout last week's chapters, these people have kind of said, like, you know, what all of the past people who don't like what the prophets are saying, they've said, like, these are all foolish traditions of our fathers. Like, they bring us no good. Like, why do we keep believing this? And eventually it gets to the point where this is the story that they're telling themselves, right? And they want it to be true so badly. Like, yeah. they don't want Jesus to be true. Like, for whatever reason, however that serves them, the text doesn't really say. Like, it's just this pretty vague, like, unrighteousness, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think fundamentalism, it can be on both sides, right? Like, it can be this really stubborn and unmovable belief or mm-hmm. need for something to be true that we kind of like put our own blinders on and we say like, nope, we're not open to anything else. We're not open to any persuasion. We're not open to any other ideas that might sway us from this one thing that we really want / need to be true. And I think, I think that's a really dangerous place to be, both for the self, because it makes us unteachable mm-hmm. and unpliable, and also to others, because once we think that we have all the answers and we know exactly how things are supposed to go, we start to alienate ourselves. And we've talked about this before, but like, no man or no woman is an island. Every choice that we make and every decision that we make affects other people. And so it's not just this like one isolated person or one isolated group that's making these decisions. Like, eventually it affects the entire community. And so a couple of questions that I think are worth asking ourselves when we come to this story of the unbelievers and the believers are the following. What do we cling to that makes us a threat to others? And this doesn't necessarily have to be like religious or spiritual, but or political even. Like, it's just what stories, what beliefs, what ideologies do we cling to that make us a threat to others? And then going along with that, how do we as individuals and as a church institution require others to prove their faith or belief before we consider it valid?
That's such a good question. And I'm just thinking of like all of the ways that people feel like they have to perform their faith, especially mm-hmm. at church. There's a sense of like everyone needs to be on the same page, and you have to, during testimony meeting, like stand up really stalwart and say like, I know, I know, I know. And those are just some of the small ways I see the church culture and church institution valuing the proof behind the faith.
And then finally, how do we weaponize our own rightness of belief? And for me, I feel like this is the one that I see happening most often in my own congregations. A lot of times, like, and it's not even just like the LDS church versus Christianity or LDS church versus like Islam or any other belief system. It's like people against people. Mm-hmm. Like, this is where scripture bashing comes in. Right. This is where like weaponizing conference talks comes in. This is where finding quotes from like prophets that validate our own opinions and beliefs come in. And so I think very often we're tempted to weaponize our own rightness because we like being right. Like, I was just telling my husband the other day, like, I like to win. I am a very competitive person and I don't like to lose. And so this one for me is pretty convicting because a lot of times, like, I can come off as very passionate and very like firm in my beliefs. And sometimes I do, like sometimes my words are harsh because I feel like I'm right. You can probably even tell on the podcast when I feel that way, you know? And so I think this is a good reminder that we don't always have all of the answers. And just because we want something to be true, or just because we believe something to be true, doesn't always necessarily mean it's the only way, or like even the most correct way to feel or think about something.
What's also telling in this set of scriptures and in our own life is not just the ways that people wait or expect or hope for prophecy to be proved or to be fulfilled, but also the ways that after prophecy has been fulfilled or after our proof has come, how does that stay with us or how do we forget it? Because in chapter 2 of 3 Nephi verses 1 and 2, it says, "And it came to pass that the 95th year passed away, and the people began to forget those signs and wonders which they had heard, and they began to be less and less astonished at the sign or a wonder from heaven." This is referring to the star that appeared in the sky when Jesus was born. It says, "Insomuch that they began to be hard in their hearts and blind in their minds, and began to disbelieve all which they had heard and seen." Which is so sad. It makes me so sad. Like, this is what you thought you wanted. This is what you thought you needed. And when it happened, there's still that lingering gap in your, not like in your faith, but you're still left yearning as if that wasn't enough. But will things, I think the question here is, well, will it ever be enough? Or what are some ways we can continue to remember these like astonishing and wondrous experiences, even if like in our 2020 day, we don't see the star in the sky because Jesus is being born? What are ways that we can remember the ways that God has shown up for us in miraculous ways?
Well, the first thought that comes to my mind, just because we've been reading the Book of Mormon so much this year, is anytime that the prophets are speaking about like faith, they always bring up, we've talked about this in past episodes, they always bring up the legacy of faith. Mm-hmm. It's always like, remember when Moses parted the waters and freed the people right. from Egypt? Right. Like, remember when, like, I don't even know who else. Moses is always, he always shows up.
Well, and it's always like, time. Don't you remember how great Lehi was when he led his family out of Jerusalem? Like,
yeah. And King Benjamin, like, Mormon especially, the narrator of the Book of Mormon, Mormon especially loves King Benjamin. Yeah. Like, he's always going back, like, it's been 95 years since King Benjamin died. Don't forget. And so I think that that legacy of faith is valuable because it's a consistent reminder of all of the ways that God has shown up for God's people. And we asked this in a past episode, but I think it's valuable to ask it again. We each have our own personal legacies of faith as well. It can be people from our family line. It can be women in the scriptures that really speak to us. And it can be our own personal experiences with the divine that we can add to this legacy of faith. And so it might be worth thinking about this week, just who and what experiences are in my own legacy of faith, and what can I do to remind myself of that?
And I think it's important for us to mention here too that we're not even advocating for like faith in the LDS structure. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there is something meaningful and enriching when we can look back on our experiences and say, wow, I felt cared for in a divine way during this time. And I remember that, and that helped shape who I am today. Or, wow, I felt like an answer to my ponderings or to my prayers. Maybe it's from God, or maybe it's just from a larger creative force, whatever it is. But I think that not just about remembering LDS faith-affirming experiences, but just remembering all of the times when you felt some type of godliness or some type of divinity show up for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you and I talked about this earlier this week, but the episode that we recorded about the experience you had when you went to see the Buddha in China. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just love that because it's just this one, the experience sounds like it was super tender and important to you. But two, I feel like it perfectly demonstrates this idea that, like, not every spiritual experience has to happen within church walls or within, like, an LDS context.
Right.
Because, like you said in that episode, you were like, God, is that you? You're mm-hmm. here too? Like, yeah. I love that. And I think, just like I said, it really demonstrates this point really well. And I can't speak for you, but at least, like, hearing you say that, it's on my legacy of faith. Like, I'm like, hey, remember that one time God showed up at the Golden Buddha for Elise? Totally earns a spot on my legacy of faith.
Well, and these stories are important, and they remind us not just of the, like, grandeur of the miracles, right? Not everyone has to go to see the Golden Buddha statue to feel this way. There is a type of everyday wonder that mm-hmm. I don't think that we should forget.
Yeah, I like the everyday wonders. And I kind of call them, for me, everyday miracles. And that's kind of what my faith is made up of, for sure. It's just like a huge conglomeration of everyday miracles. And one of the questions that I like to think about is, how can we become less dismissive of the everyday miracles? And I think for me, a gratitude practice has made everyday miracles become a lot more apparent and a lot less easy to dismiss. For me, everyday miracles look like when I plant a seed in the garden and then all of a sudden there's a sprout, like 3 days later. I'm like, wow, that happened really fast. And then just to watch, like, how fast it grows, and then to see the flowers on the pumpkin plants open, and then to see actual pumpkins grow from the ground. I'm always like, how are we, like, how do we not bend down and, like, kiss the earth when this happens? Like, to me, it's just so amazing. It's so amazing. Or the fact that, like, corn stalks can grow taller than me, and they just mm-hmm. keep going, and they're big and huge and gigantic, and I can't get over it. It's so – that is an everyday miracle to me. Mm-hmm. And, like, watching my kids at night when they're sleeping in their bed and they're just breathing quietly, I'm like, oh, this is an everyday miracle. They're not screaming. And so it's just these, like, it's just these small, tiny moments where, and not all of them are small. Like, there have been times where I've been in, like, a big family gathering and the kids are laughing and, like, the adults just told, like, a funny joke and everyone's just enjoying, and, like, there's smell of hot cider on the stove and there's soft music playing in the other room, and there's just this moment where I kind of, I don't know, look around and I think, like, I think this is what heaven looks like. Mm-hmm. And if you know me, if you spend any time with me at all, there are moments where, like, we'll be sitting at a restaurant with, like, perfect lighting and amazing food and great company, and I'll say, like, I think that this is what heaven looks like.
Yeah.
Or I think that this is what food in heaven will taste like. And I, for me personally, like, those have been the most solidified, like, spiritual experiences for me, because it just drives home for me the importance of the everyday. Like, it reminds me to be present, and it reminds me that, like, the heaven that I'm waiting for is already here. Mm-hmm. It's already here. And I'm just so, so obsessed with that. And it makes me not want to miss the sacredness in the everyday, in the people that I'm with all of the time, and the goodness of God that's, like, here. I don't have to wait for it. Like, I don't have to wait for Jesus to come. I don't have to wait for a star in the sky. Like, Jesus is already here. And it's, like, seriously, that's been the most important thing for me. Like, it's totally changed my faith. It's totally changed the way, like, I view the world, to realize that heaven's already here and I don't have to wait around for it. Like, mm-hmm. oh, it's so cool. Like, I'm literally holding my head, like, trying to hold my brain in, because it literally feels like I need to explode, because it's just so awesome.
Yeah. This is so beautiful. It reminds me of a passage from, she's a feminist philosopher. Her name is Lusa Rigorai, and she wrote once that the celestial lies not only above our heads, but between us. And I feel like as we remember to be open to the mystery and the wonder of this everyday sacredness and this everyday divinity, then we don't get so preoccupied waiting for miracles to come. Like, yeah, we don't get so caught up on the idea of prophecies to be fulfilled. And I wonder if the Nephites and the Lamanites and this group of believers and unbelievers, if they weren't caught up and so preoccupied with the sign that was to come, if they had slowed down and recognized the everyday wondrous miracles in their own communities, might they have been a little more compassionate towards one another? Might mm-hmm. they have been a little more appreciative of the ways that the divine or the creative power already shows up for them, as opposed to counting down the days to try and prove or disprove Sammy the Lamanite's prophecy?
I agree with everything you said, Elise. And I think, I said this in last week's episode and I'll say it again. Elise and I decided we need to make pins or stickers or something with like all of our quote, like our most said phrases on the podcast. And apparently one of mine is, I don't know how to say this any differently or any better. But it's true. I don't know how to say this differently or any better. That God is already here and God is already among us. And all we need to do is be present and stay open to all of the miracles that God is giving us every day. The star in this story, it rises bright as day. But guess what? Stars and suns and moons rise for us always, even still. Can we be open enough to see God in this also? Or are we waiting for a sign in the sky?
The final piece that we want to talk about in this episode comes from chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. And this is where we see an explicit mention that the curse of dark skin is being taken away from the Lamanites. And to provide a little bit more context, the Gadianton robbers have showed up here and they're like super numerous and they're slaying a lot of people and destroying their cities. And it says they did spread so much death and carnage throughout the land that it became expedient that all the people, both the Nephites and the Lamanites, should take up arms against them. So the Nephites and the Lamanites, they're uniting in one singular powerful force for good. They build like a one singular united body in defense against the Gadianton robbers. And in verse 15, it says, and their curse was taken from them, and their skin became white like unto the Nephites, and their young men and their young daughters became exceedingly fair, and they were numbered among the Nephites, and they were called Nephites. And thus ended the 13th year. Ay, ay, ay.
We got to unpack that.
Yeah. Some of my thoughts that I'm having. Why is it just now being explicitly mentioned that the curse is being taken from the Lamanites? I guess I don't understand what is so powerful about this type of union between the Nephites and the Lamanites, because a few books or chapters ago, like, the Lamanites were more righteous than the Nephites, and the Nephites mm-hmm. and the Lamanites have already been like living together somewhat harmoniously. And so right. I just question, like, what is it about this time that the curse, like, why was the curse removed from them now? And the other thing that makes this really challenging is that I don't, like, there is a racist, this is a racist verse because it says that the curse, it literally connects it to the color of skin. Mm-hmm. And it says when the curse is taken from them, their skin became white. And the implication here is that, I don't know what, that the Lamanites have now like reached their peak righteousness. And so they get, quote, like rewarded with whiteness. That's right. Messed up.
Yeah. Well, and like you and I talked about earlier, like it's hard not to make this verse about race because it literally makes it about race.
About race, yeah.
It makes it about the color of your skin. I guess what I'm feeling frustrated with this verse because it does make it about their skin color. And it also says that, like, dark skin is bad, essentially, right? Like, it's unrighteous. And then it also says that, like, skin color can be changed according to your righteousness, which we also know, like, at least from the science we have today, that your skin color doesn't change. But also, what I'm hearing from the Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities is that their skin color is important to them. It's part of their identity. It's part of their heritage. It's part of who they are. And so, like, I find it a little offensive and a little weird that the text says, like, oh, their skin color was taken away from them. And I just, at least nowadays, like, I'm not sure that that would, like, pass as kosher. You know what I mean?
Well, and, like, I also am not super interested in, like, factual proof of why this is not about skin color, because what happens with these verses is that they get weaponized toward BIPOC communities. Like, so whether or not you can do factual proof that this isn't really talking about race doesn't necessarily matter to me when these verses have been used for so long to justify racism and to justify racism within the church.
I don't have the exact post, but Flora Familiar, Michelle Franzoni Thorley, who we've talked about on the podcast before, has shared experiences of her own family as, like, they've had interracial marriages that, like, occasionally prophets have said, like, used these exact verses to say, like, look, the missionaries are marrying, like, indigenous peoples, and now their children are becoming white. So look, like, this is exact verse in action. So I'm with you. Like, I don't much care for, like, proof that these scriptures aren't, like, weren't written with the intent to be racist. What matters to me, just same as you, is that they have been used as racial justifications for the last, since whenever the Book of Mormon showed up.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
well, I think it's a good reminder about intent versus impact. Like, Oh, they didn't intend for it to be about race, or, oh, they didn't intend for it to come off like that. Well, like, this is what the impact of these verses has been. And especially now, if there is a desire to stand with particularly the Black community right now in the Black Lives Matter movement, then, like, when we come across these verses, we shouldn't just be wary of them, but we need to be explicit in calling them out for what they do, and then either try and offer a creative interpretation of them, or just say, like, nope, this isn't serving us. This is going to stay in the dead past.
Yeah. Well, and the other thought that I have about this too is, you know, when the curse originally comes up, it's about unrighteousness, right? Mm-hmm. But then we read the whole Book of Mormon essentially at this point, and we see the Nephites going through their own cycle of righteousness and unrighteousness. And guess what? They never get a curse of dark skin.
Right.
So it really begs the question at that point, like, is the curse really about righteousness? Mm-hmm. Or is it about racism?
Well, yeah, and if it was
about racism.
Well, and if it was about righteousness, then why wasn't the curse lifted when the Lamanites were exceeding the Nephites in this righteousness, like, righteousness off? Like, who's better than who? Who's more righteous than who?
Right, exactly. They're just icky. Like, the verses are icky. And I kind of just want to, like right now, I'm kind of just, like, wanting to shake them off and be like, ew, get these away from me. But at the same time, this is part, as a white woman, this is part of my own anti-racism work.
Right.
To say, like, this is part of my heritage. This is in my own text that I call sacred. And I need to deal with it. Like, I don't get to just shake it off and say, like, oh, whatever, those are in the past. Like, they didn't really mean it the way that everyone else is saying that they mean it. Like, well, it's my job to say, What if they did mean it?
Right.
In exactly the way that it's coming across.
Right.
What if it is racist? And to sit with that discomfort and to just say, like, I really need to examine this, and then be explicit in calling it out, it can be really uncomfortable. So if you're feeling that same feeling of like icky and discomfort, I invite you to sit with that. And I invite you to be curious about it. And I invite you to recognize that those feelings of ickiness are small compared to what members of color and Black members and Indigenous members feel when they read these verses too. And just to recognize that and like then befriend that and say, okay, now what are we going to do to fix it? Mm-hmm. It's all part of the process.
Right. I'm really glad that you brought that up because, yeah, as much as we can say, like, well, sit with it and, like, let yourself be uncomfortable. Like, while we're doing that, racism has dire consequences mm-hmm. for real people that mm-hmm. we know today. So, yes, take the time that we need to learn and whatever else, but, like, we got to get the show on the road here. Like,
yeah, like, hurry up.
People are dying. Right.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. I feel you.
In this union between the Nephites and the Lamanites, I also find it interesting that what unites the people is not just a common enemy, but it's the value of justice and valuing their women and their children. They want to maintain their rights and all of their privileges to worship as they want, and they're fighting for their freedom and liberty together. I think it's a beautiful understanding of the ways that we can think, okay, are we more the same than we are different? And how can I see that you are both like me and unlike me, and we can still come together towards a common goal to keep all of us safe?
Yeah, and I think we can even take that one step further and say, like, can I possibly learn not just to accept our differences, but to appreciate them and integrate them as a valuable part of our community? Instead of valuing sameness, valuing variety and differentiation.
Whew, I bet you didn't know that we had so much to say about only the first two chapters of this whole entire block of text. So there are still 5 more chapters that we weren't even able to cover here in this episode. But we encourage you to do your own work and share your ideas with friends and loved ones and new community members, or share them with us. We'd love to hear what new ideas you have for the rest of these chapters.
We're always so grateful to spend this time with you. And we're excited on Monday when we get to release this episode, because it's just really meaningful to have that experience of sharing our interpretation with our community, and that's you. So we love you. We can't wait to hear from you this week, and we'll see you soon. Bye.